Excuse me, this is the conference coordinator. We'd like to inform all participants today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect. Now I'll turn the call over to your host, and you may begin when ready.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the BC Members Pre-Council call taking place on the 10th of September 2012. On the call today, we have Jim Sinolosuye, Elisa Cooper, Jim Baskin, Andrew Graham, Marilyn Kay, Frederick Selman, Gabriela Slack, Sarah Deutsch, Ron Andrus, Chris Taplow, Cyril Lehrman, Andrew Abram, Steve Del Bianco, and John Berard. And we have apologies from Zahid Jamil, Philip Corwin, Lynn Goodendorf, Ellen Vidron, Chris Bohm, Bill Smith, and David Ferris. And I would like to remind participants to please state their names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you, and over to you, Marilyn.
Thank you, Bindi. I just need to verify this. We have apologies. Can you go through that again, please?
Of course. From Zahid Jamil, Philip Corwin, Lynn Goodendorf, Alain Vidron, Chris Bohm, Bill Smith, and David Ferris. Well, Philip Corwin might join, but late.
Okay. I just wanted to see where we had some duplication. So we have the counselors covered with Zahid. We have Chris Bohm from Verizon is covered by Sarah being here. So that was my only purpose in asking that clarification. Thank you very much. Marilyn Cade, as chair, I'd just like to kick this call off to say it's going to be a very aggressively busy call, and we may not even get to all the things we need to talk about. We'll cover what we can from an informational perspective and take further discussion by email as needed. This is the pre-BC call, but we will have the BC pre-council call. The council, the GNSO Policy Council, has a call on the 13th, that's Thursday, and so we're going to dedicate a significant amount of the time of this call to topics that are coming up on the council agenda, but we have a number of other things we want to cover for informational and feedback purposes. And I want to start by opening a discussion about defensive registrations. Let me do a bit of reorder. I'd like to start with some feedback from the DC, the Department of Commerce PTO event last week, and ask Steve to kick that off. Originally, that event was not open. It was an event that was invitational from a group of people who call themselves the brands. But the good news is requests from me and others led to opening that meeting, and we had several members there. Sarah's on the call. Steve was there. I was there. Phil was there. Lisa was on the phone. Susan Kawaguchi was on the phone. I think Anjali was on the phone. So let me kick off with a brief overview of that meeting. And, Steve, you did a great summary. Could I ask you to kick off with the summary of that meeting?
Sure, Marilyn. In June 2012, a lot of these brands got together and held a brand summit here in the United States, and their purpose was, after having seen the 1,400 strings, 1,900 applications, the magnitude of defensive registration problem was increased in their eyes. So they felt the need to come together with a unified voice to the GAC and USG and to ICANN, a unified voice on sort of expressing their preference for better rights protection mechanisms given the magnitude and size of the new TLDs. So they prepared a three-page letter, and I attached that to the report I circulated. And their three-page letter was still very high level. It's not a lot of details, but it's a high-level request for some of the very same things that the business constituency suggested we'd need in the way of additional rights protection mechanisms, even before we knew the magnitude of the new round. One was on the trademark claims service, that it ought to run longer than 60 days. The brand letter didn't say for how long, but the BC has said perpetually, and we've often said, or at least for 3 years, or until a review of the effectiveness of the trademark claims warnings notices. The brand letter, though, also said that it's more than just identical match. They thought the trademark claims notice emails, and again, these are warnings. They don't stop the registration. They just warn the person registering, as well as the trademark holder, that this could be a trademark concern. So they're including not just identical match, but any domain name that contains a mark that's in the trademark clearinghouse, you know, including a name that has a trademark clearinghouse plus any generic word like support, PayPal-support, PayPal-payment would be the examples of things that would generate a registration name, generate a trademark claims notice. They also came out and said that sunrise periods should include the opportunity for a brand owner to impose a block in perpetuity. Remember that everyone, we've discussed this before, it's one of the BC positions as well. It's modeled sort of on what ICM did for the .XXX registry, where you could block in perpetuity. And finally, on the Uniform Rapid Suspension System, or URS, they wanted the trademark clearinghouse to tie into URS, and that the default judgments should not warrant a panel appointment. It ought to be a lot faster, and that the loser would pay the fees in a URS filing. I would also mention to you they agreed with the BCs that ICANN should sort of manage and run the URS system on a low-cost or no-cost basis. And finally, they came up with an idea that said that recidivist bad actors, that's a new term from them, recidivist bad actors should be tracked via a list of common respondents, and the list should be publicly available. So the notion that repeat offenders with respect to URS and UDRP would be tracked and listed in a public list. And that didn't meet with a lot of approval when it was surfaced at the meeting on September the 5th. So the letter I've just summarized for you was the letter that was discussed on the September the 5th meeting at the U.S. Commerce Department. And it was hosted jointly by the U.S. Commerce Department, NTIA, Undersecretary Larry Strickling, as well as the head of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, David Kapos. Marilyn Cade was there, myself, Phil Corwin, Susan Kawaguchi was on the phone for the BC. So they went through their entire list of ideas, and there was a lot of discussion. Marilyn and I were able to reiterate some of the previously voted on and approved BC positions. Bill Corwin took note of the fact that these trademark claims notices might well have a chilling effect on a registrant. That is pretty much the intent of the trademark claims notice, is to give a tiny bit of pause to a registrant if they maybe didn't know that the term they just tried to register was a trademark term and included a trademark term. Phil expressed concern, and I don't know if Phil's with us today on the phone, but he expressed concern that that could chill some creative domain name registration. And I think that is the intent, is to put a little bit of a gate on that in case there's a trademark term involved. Susan Kawaguchi of Facebook was on the phone and weighed in with some fantastic data from Facebook's experience on watch services, because David Kapos of the Patent and Trademark Office asked everyone there, why can't you just expand your use of watch services? And these are commercially available services run by a number of vendors that will watch a given zone in cooperation with registrars and report back when trademark-related claims, trademark-related terms are registered. Marilyn and others noted that depends upon cooperation of registrars, which is not always there. Marilyn noted that the sheer magnitude of several hundred zones to deal with means that the cost and complexity of this will go up. And we also noted that this doesn't notify the registrant that they may be treading on a trademark. It simply notifies the trademark holder, who's then sort of given the obligation to track something down after it's already been locked and registered and perhaps even content's been put up. So at the end of the meeting, I'll wrap up by saying that Larry Strickling of the Commerce Department said, well, look, we're sensitive to this, but we're also sensitive to two things. Critics think that the U.S. dominates the Internet too much, so don't ask the U.S. government to weigh in alone on asking for these additional rights protection mechanisms. Make sure other governments are involved. And I think that's important to everyone on this call. And the second point Larry said is that I need to know what has changed since the U.S. government wrote a letter to ICANN in January of 2012. How does the U.S. government explain why these additional second-level RPMs are needed when they weren't insisted upon back in January? As you, many of you recall, in January, the U.S. government responded to a lot of brand concerns at the top level for defensive applications. BC continues to believe that was a misguided concern, took their eye off the ball for second level, and now we're reaping the the pains of having misdirected that, because now second level is seen as somehow new when in fact it's been a consistent drumbeat of concern from the BC and others for years. So I'll stop there, and Marilyn, put it back to you.
Thanks. Steve, if I can, I just want to be sure I've captured everyone who was on the call and with us in the room. We had Sarah Deutsch, yourself, myself, Phil Corwin in the room, and on the phone we had Elisa Cooper, Susan Kawaguchi, and Angelie Hansen from Better Business Bureau. We may have missed someone who, and I think also Fairwinds Partners was in the room, but really strongly representing their own interest and leadership. So I didn't actually include them, but I do want to note that they were there.
Yeah, my apologies, Sarah. You made some great points in the meeting. I should have remembered to put your name down. Sorry.
No problem.
So one thing I'd just like to say about the Larry Strickland comments, I did meet with him very briefly afterward. Two things. Larry is actually saying not just non-U.S. government, he is saying non-U.S. brands. And I want to flag that for us because I think that's a big question for us to come back to on how we get our colleagues from ICC, WITSA. I know Jimson is on the phone and has a new organization in Africa. But we need to begin asking ourselves, we have Suya and we have Gabby on the phone, we need to be asking ourselves, how are we reaching out to the brands that are not U.S.-based, but would share our concerns, and how do we do that? We can't spend a lot of time on that issue on this call, but I think it is an important topic. And some of the companies have, so we need to think global brand with brand recognition in other countries, how to get those countries engaged, but also non-U.S.-based brands. I'm just going to park that thought for us to come back to, but I think it is an important message, and we're going to need to figure this out fairly soon. Other comments about, I want to talk about the three positions that are on the table. So there's a BC position paper, there's a Melbourne IT position paper, and there's a paper from a group of entities that defines themselves as the brand, IP brand holders that held the IP brand summit in New York. Can we kind of talk about those? There's a lot of consistency between the three positions, but I do think the BC needs to have its own position, and I've seen support for that from Sarah, from Elisa, and from others. And so maybe we should just talk about the draft that I sent around. It builds on existing positions the BC has taken, but it does really reinforce the idea that we want ICANN to implement improvements to the defensive registration mechanisms in the near term. So why don't we just open a conversation, Steve, on the various suggestions for improvement.
So thanks, Marilyn. This is the document attached to the agenda. It's labeled Draft : Chair's Proposal for Discussion and Finalization. Is that correct?
Yes.
Great. And so as policy coordinator for the BC, I took it upon myself to compare this with previously approved, voted upon BC positions, and did find three ways in which, as you said, it's expanded, take account of new information and so on. But it's important to point that out to the BC members of the three areas in this document that go somewhat beyond voted upon BC positions. And I can do that in turn as you go through each item or go right to those items up front to speed things up. What's your preference?
Why don't you do what is your preference?
Great. We'll do quickly. I'll just cover the items that haven't already been voted upon and discussed ad nauseum in the BC. And the first one is under the very first item where ICANN has to be able to enforce all registry restrictions. There's a sentence in here that says penalties should include warnings followed by second warning plus fines and finally transfer of the registry management. And that's somewhat different than what the BC voted on in January of this year when we said that ICANN would be in charge of enforcing the contract, and if in fact they had to enforce, they would use the ordinary registry contract breach notice procedure as well as the post-delegation dispute resolution procedure. So we sort of anticipated that by sticking these things into the registry contract that the ordinary contractual enforcement mechanism would kick in. So when you say that, it's probably then not necessary to delineate penalties, first and second warnings, and transfers, because we probably want to use the existing ICANN procedures for breach notification and dispute resolution. So my recommendation to the BC is to drop that sentence starting with the word penalties.
And it's Marilyn. Let me propose, I support you, Steve. So if we drop that, is that
then
it's okay?
Consistent with previous positions.
Yes.
Great. Let's move on then. Number four is the do not register. Do not register, again, modeled on the ICM proposal supported by the brands, is something the BC did vote on in January. When we came up with it in January, it was new at the time, and it was approved by a majority of the BC. We had said that it would be a one-time fee to permanently block names that are an identical match or that they include an identical match. So the way Marilyn's phrased the first part of 4 is already approved BC position. But I did want to point out that 4A is something new, because in 4A it talks about moving to do not resolve things that have been the subject of a UDRP or a URS or a DMCA notice. And the BC is very concerned about those strings, and we had suggested that those become part of the trademark clearinghouse, and therefore they're available for trademark claims notices. But this would be the first time that the BC said that they automatically go on to a do not register. And it's a subtle distinction, but if something goes into the trademark clearinghouse, it's available for a do not register. It automatically is available for trademark claims notices, but it doesn't automatically go onto a block list. This 4A in Maryland's draft would automatically put them onto a block list. So that's worthy of discussion at the BC since it's not a previously approved position. And the only other one I had to note was the next paragraph that says dealing with overzealous protective requests. And I think this is a well-constructed point, but it is also new for the BC. It's not a particularly controversial one. And I think it's very positive, but I just wanted to let you know that it's new. I'll stop there, Marilyn. What kind of a structure
your
voting should proceed?
Yeah, can I just speak first of all to why I inserted the overzealous request?
Sure, go for it.
And I'm not speaking as the chair. I'm speaking as someone who has worked for years in this space, chaired the previous Who Is Task Force, helped to devise and put the UDRP into, with Sarah's help, into ICANN's portfolio. Here's my concern. If we do not provide a mechanism to free up what are viewed by free speech advocates and some governments as overzealous requests by trademark holders, then I think we will find ourselves being blocked. If we provide a mechanism that enables an examination of such concerns, I think we'll find more friends. The mechanism has to be fair to trademark holders and to those who are being exploited, as well as to those who actually are registering names for valid reasons. I'm trying to come up with an example, but there are examples where, actually, how about if I use the word ICANN Watch? So ICANN Watch is a probably a valid registration of a string, and I'm using it because it's not so controversial for us. But ICANN Watch probably is a valid registration of a string that is, if the first few letters were Verizon Watch or Facebook Watch or Microsoft Watch or Qualcomm Watch, but I think we need to have our own proposal on a responsible mechanism for overzealous requests, and that is why I put that in there.
Got it. So the only, this is both under 4A, right, Marilyn? The
yep.
The one you just described is really just a modifier to 4A. And I wanted to remind the BC is that our previously approved position, 3.4, was that a successful URS or UDRP complainant could not only transfer or suspend the name, but those names would automatically go into the trademark clearinghouse and subsequently generate trademark claims warnings and notices. So that if a URS proceeding against a cyber squatter who got onto PayPal-support and won the URS proceeding, the words PayPal-support would automatically go to the trademark clearinghouse, and therefore they're available for purchasing a block on PayPal's behalf, or PayPal could simply not block it and allow warnings to come up every time. So the way the BC had constructed this earlier, Marilyn, is that by moving these successful URS and UDRPs into the trademark clearinghouse, they automatically become available for the trademark owner to purchase the block, or if they don't, the warnings stay active forever. So what you've done with 4A is to change that in a way that rather than putting them into the clearinghouse, you automatically move them to a do not register. And so I would ask you and the other members of the call whether that's an improvement on what the BC had already approved or not. It's my personal opinion that what the BC already approved gives far more flexibility to the trademark holder, since they could purchase the block or allow it to, or spend no money and allow it to generate trademark warning notices in the future. The idea of putting them automatically on the list brings the added obligation to add the paragraph you did, which is finding a way to get them off the list if it was overzealous.
This is Sarah. We support having more than the exact mark on the block. We've already kind of been burned by this issue through ICM registry, so we paid money to get Verizon on do not register for .XXX. And the week it opened, somebody took Verizon Business and Verizon Wireless, and you know that didn't protect us. So having like the idea of including your exact mark with another name is extremely useful, because the cyber squatters they're not, you know, Josh Bourne said this very well at the meeting, the trademark owners do a good job of trying to protect their exact brands, but everyone else who's making money on this is making money off of the variations.
Right, Sarah, and 4A, sorry, 4, not 4A, but 4, already reflects exactly what you just said, and that is already an approved BC position.
Okay, good. Yeah, I wasn't clear whether that was new or approved.
I'm just focusing on 4A, which says that coming out of a UDRP or URS, if a brand new item, it's not something that you had already had in the trademark clearinghouse, you hadn't purchased a block on it yet, but you win it in a URS or UDRP, Maryland's suggesting that it automatically move into the block list, whereas the BC's current approved position is that it simply moves into the trademark clearinghouse, where it is available for purchasing of a block or permanent trademark claims notice warnings.
Hey, Steve, this is John.
Go ahead.
So, I, as I said in my comments last week on this matter, I am concerned about creating this kind of blanket coverage. And I think that there are more examples than just ICANN Watch. I mean, every company on the planet has got both supporters and detractors that use the company's name in URLs that are most of which are pretty clear as to what they intend. And I would hate to see that legitimate use of a company's brand be barred. Certainly, there are problems with the current protection mechanisms that there are opportunities to strengthen them. But at this point, I think that's where the focus ought to be, so as not to squelch everything by creating a blanket rule. The other thing, and this is something that I've been vexed with for a long time, is that UDRP findings don't create precedence among the UDRP service providers. And to suggest now that we're now going to bolt, we're sort of going to retrofit precedence onto UDRP by this BC position seems to me to be, the wrong way to go about it. I mean, I'm sorry Phil's not on the call. I know that he's been adamant about strengthening the systems in place and the people delivering them on UDRP. But, you know, the example that came to mind is Priceless.com, right? So MasterCard took Priceless.com to a UDRP hearing, and they won, even though Priceless.com was in active use years before somebody at MasterCard ever cooked up the Priceless campaign. And that's, you know, I didn't think that that was an appropriate decision, but yet if the BC position is in place, then Priceless becomes now a wholly owned and only able to be used by MasterCard, which I'm not quite sure is the right way to go either. So I don't know. I have some concerns about reach exceeding our grasp on some of these matters, and there may be better ways to achieve the goals that we are looking to achieve.
Steve, I need to ask John a question. It's Marilyn.
Go ahead.
Would my reverse mechanism satisfy your concern on a word that is basically a generic word or a dictionary word that has been maybe used by one entity, but it does change the... Would the reverse mechanism at least address that?
You're talking about the overzealous pursuit?
Yes, the overzealous pursuit.
The overzealous pursuit is good, except that, you know, that's also a subjective measure. I'm not insensitive to the fact that we are creating global marks based on national law. I'm not insensitive to the fact that it's easier to get a trademark in countries, in other countries, not the United States. I also, you know, I have a number of bookmarks on my browser that give me insight into companies like Apple and IBM and Deutsche Telekom. And they have Deutsche Telekom and Apple and IBM in the URL, but they are not products of those companies.
Right.
And I would not enter
right.
that kind of... I wouldn't want to do anything to impinge upon that ability.
Marilyn, this is Sarah. I think that, you know, this issue can be resolved by what was suggested, which is creating a mechanism where if somebody feels that a trademark owner is overreached and asking for the block, that there could be a challenge even with the loser pays, you know, price tag at the end to make sure that the process works in a balanced way. But I think we can't ignore the fact that cyber squatting and phishings and frauds are a huge problem, and 70% of the UDRP cases are a default. And so, you know, the balance should be in favor of a remedy that works, but also build in something on the back end so that the abuses, you know, can occur.
Marilyn, it's Steve.
So,
I wanted to clarify that,
John. If I could just suggest that maybe the best first step is to look at user pays in the current right protection mechanism regime.
Sarah, you want to reply to that?
Well, I mean, it's a great idea. We'd love loser pays in the UDRP, but the problem is you know, WIPO has no authority to collect money from any of these cyber squatters. They default. They don't even answer. So, but on a mechanism like the block list, where there is somebody out there who thinks they have a legitimate right to the name, then it works. It works very well there. It could work in the URS too if the registrant was willing to. The registrant has to be willing to agree to it. It's a problem. The brand owner would be willing to agree to it.
And so that's where the Melbourne IT definition of what represents a brand in this instance would come into play?
Well, Melbourne IT has their own idea of only applying to high-risk brands or high-risk marks, whatever those are.
Right. So, I, and again, so you see, now we get into a rather gray area of what's a mark and what's a mark with a capital M, what's a mark with a lowercase m.
Well, that's a different debate that could take up hours, and that isn't the subject of what we're talking about, really.
But it is, I think.
And John, Steve, I do want to try to be cognizant of all the members' time, because
some of
this discussion is retreading positions that are already approved by the BC earlier this year, and we also are dealing with the chair's potential additions.
Right. I was only trying to deal with four.
Suggestion goes back and undoes some things the BC has already approved. And then we have the brand's proposal, which is somewhat different than the BC. And finally, we have Melbourne IT, which is significantly different than the BC. And when you stir all that together, if the BC doesn't start to move down the path of concrete proposals, we will simply fall back for our official position, as we represented at ICANN. Our official position is what we voted upon in January. And keep in mind that what we voted on in January has two elements that are at issue
in this
discussion. The first is that the block is available to the trademark owner, and they can block their trademark term plus any other domain name that includes their trademark term plus any other word. That's what we have in our current approved position. So Verizon could block Verizon Business, but they could also block Verizon Stinks, right? And we didn't design a mechanism in the BC's position, a mechanism to pull that back. The other BC position was that if you're successful in a URS UDRP, then the name that you were successful against, you have the option to take it, suspend it through a block, or have it stick in the trademark clearinghouse so that it generates notices. Now, you guys seem to be worried that Verizon might win a Verizon Stinks URS or UDRP proceeding, but aren't we counting upon the URS UDRP vendors to be cognizant of free expression concerns when they issue their ruling?
No, I don't have that confidence any longer.
All right, so the existing BC position is probably more protective of trademarks than what the brands came up with in June, and certainly more so than what Melbourne IT came up with. So believe it or not, we are stronger than the brand's proposal in one important regard. The brand's proposal is that the block is only available to a trademark term like Verizon, plus any of the generic words that Verizon has registered in their trademark application. So the word wireless, the word phone service, the word internet, those would all be things that are probably in Sarah's trademark application. So the brand's proposal would allow those. The BC didn't restrict it that way. We said virtually any generic word associated with the word Verizon. So, Marilyn, I'm going to look to you for some guidance on timing here. The only proposal on the table is the chair's draft. We've already amended it a little bit by dropping the penalties part in favor of the PDDRP. And item 4A is new and would probably require a consensus or voting process from the BC before it were to become official BC position. And I did want to point out that 4A is different from what the BC had already approved, which was a mechanism that drives everything to the trademark clearinghouse instead of automatically into the block.
Well, we have time to do a vote if we need to, but I think our bigger issue, it's Marilyn speaking, our bigger issue is to decide whether we are going to lead on behalf of the brands and the users. You know, I sent an email to 2,000 companies asking them if they were aware of that. For the past 2 years, I the project manager on a G20 project. And that list has a huge number of brands from developing countries. And the MENA region, the Asia-Pacific region, and Latin America. And I sent an email out to those folks who were invited to the G20 and asked them if they were aware of what is going on at ICANN. And the fact is they're not. So we are facing a challenge where we want to create a mechanism which is fair to the existing dominant brands, but is also open and inclusive of the concerns of brands from the rest of the world. I'm not sure that my addition that, but I do want us to, if we need to do a vote on a couple of additional issues, we can. I think, Steve, that if we could just isolate the only areas that are different from what we've already agreed and see if they are enhancements against the proposals from the Melbourne proposal and the IP Brand Summit proposals. Is that maybe, if we could just do that right now, and then we know what we need to vote on before we go into a meeting on the 18th where all of the proposals on the table are going to be discussed, and then some effort is going to be made to have either individual proposals to the board for change or congruent proposals. And I think that's our priority. How do we affect change at ICANN? We've got to be as aligned as possible with other like-minded parties. If we're presenting disparate and widely diverse proposals for changes, we're not going to get anything.
All right, Marilyn, I can respond to that to say that the, in two areas, the blocks service and in a broader interpretation of Trademark Clearinghouse, the BC is consistent with not only the IPC and global brands, but also Melbourne IT's proposal. And I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg. Maybe Melbourne picked up some of their ideas from the BC. But we are very consistent. What your letter ends up doing is slightly tweaking previous BC positions in ways that make them consistent with neither Melbourne IT or the brands. It's possible to say that the BC has been very supportive of protecting users and registrants. Remember, we're not out there protecting brands per se. It's really the users and the registrants from confusion. We are very consistent with that, but there is no 100% agreement between a Melbourne IT, the brand's proposal, and the BC, nor necessarily does there need to be, since if by some way of pressure ICANN moved ahead with another special trademark study group, that is where the details would be worked out, drawing upon all three plans plus any other things that they looked at. So I'm confident the BC is on record and very vocal at advocating for the protections that are here, the ones we've already approved, and that there probably isn't necessary to take it much further than that. If it's the will of the group, I'm happy to compare the three proposals on the table and the ways in which they're different, and to try to come up with some sort of a BC voting procedure to get there. But I'm not convinced we need to be 100% consistent with either of those two plans.
Steve, this is Alisa.
Yes.
There's one other issue I'd like for us to consider adding, and I don't think we've had any discussion on it, but it is something that I think brands and companies should be concerned with, and that is, and we didn't know about this until we actually saw the list of applications, and that is the scenario where brands have applied for these very generic terms with the intention of only allowing themselves to have registrations, and I think that's potentially harmful for brands as well. I don't know what other spots are, whether it fits into this letter, whether we could even include something like that at this late stage, but it is something that I think we should consider taking a position on, because I don't think it really falls into the, you know, any of the other constituencies.
The BC had been very vocal. This is prior to that, but we had been very vocal in suggesting that if brands did apply for their own top-level domain, that they'd be given important exceptions. They should not have to use all registrars. They should not have to turn their registry over to ICANN if they decided to shut it down. Right? We said that certain elements of the code of conduct could not apply. They're all approved upon and voted by the BC. But I missed what it was you said. Is there some new concern about brand top-level domains that we haven't addressed?
Let me just give you an example. So, for instance, Progressive, the auto, car, home insurance company, applied for .insurance with the intention of only allowing themselves to have registrations in that registry, and therefore not allowing State Farm or AAA or Farmers or any other insurance company to ever have a .insurance registration. I really don't think that was in the spirit of what ICANN had intended. There's nothing in the guidebook that prohibits that specifically, but I think it's concerning for brands.
But so it's not just insurance. It's Amazon doing .book, Google doing .search and .app. There are many examples of a corporate applicant for a generic term, not a trademark term, a generic word term, which they want to operate in a closed fashion. So that's very different than a dot brand, but it is a single registrant top-level domain. They are proposing to run the closed
registrant. Actually, Steve, it's Marilyn. I think I need to get in the queue on this.
Okay, so just to finish, the BC didn't have any previously applied position with respect to a single registrant TLD other than that for a trademark. And
okay.
So you bring up the notion of whether they're going to operate a generic term in a closed fashion that could be exclusionary or discriminatory against other competitors. So we'll take a cue on that.
And I'd like to be in the cue first as the chair.
All right, Marilyn, go ahead.
I've sent an email to the list, but I'm going to say it again on the list. We all need to be really cognizant of conflicts of interest. When we speak on behalf of a particular position, if we have a conflict of interest or we have a member who has a conflict of interest, let's declare that. I do not represent anyone who is applying, and I'm going to say something about the issue of generic words that are being applied for by anyone, not just a brand holder, but anyone, even someone who I might personally think is a speculative a registry. Anyone who's providing a registration for a word that is associated with an industry. So that word could be .finance, .bank, .insurance, .hotels. Those words, if they are closed, I think do raise some interesting questions about exclusionary practices. I'm not suggesting that the applicant necessarily always had that in mind, but I don't think we can treat such applications as being an application by a brand holder, Steve. I think application...
Right, that's right. That's what I said. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I misunderstood you. It sounded like you said brand holders applied for such words, but that's not really the point.
No. It's anybody who applies for a generic word that intends to operate it closed.
And I think that was the point that I heard Elisa trying to make. So
that's right. And Elisa brought it up with respect to a company that was also in that industry, but it wouldn't necessarily have to be. It may have been someone else applying for dot insurance. But the fact that it's Progressive, which is a member of that industry and has some level of market power, I think it's what gives rise to the concerns that I've heard. I had asked the U.S. government whether they, for instance, were thinking of early warnings with respect to some companies with major market power running a closed generic TLD. And the answer I got is not so far. Not so far. They weren't necessarily going to be concerned about it enough to raise it to an early warning. Now, many other governments could have very different positions. But I know that what Elisa is asking about it, and you're commenting on, is whether should the BC make a comment or make a statement of principle with respect to a generic word being run in a closed fashion by a company that might use exclusionary or discriminatory policies. And Marilyn, if you weren't finished, I wanted to give you more time for that before we open the broader queue.
No, I just think that people need to, if they speak on this, if they have a conflict of interest, they need to declare it.
Great. Anyone else in the queue on whether the BC should consider a position about this? All right, we'll close that queue, but Elisa, at least you, Marilyn, and I have all been discussing this issue and wondering how to deal with it. If any of the three of us or all three of us want to try to draft something, we can run it through the BC approval process. I imagine it would be a statement of principle, but it would need to be rather quickly, since if the BC came to a statement of principle on this, it'd be something that would be shared with governments that are in a position to raise an antitrust or concern of that fashion, since the way in which an application would get modified is more likely through a government early warning than through something the BC would say.
Okay.
Elisa, anything further on that topic? Because I think that is outside of rights protection mechanisms. The chair's proposal, which we had on the table earlier, was more focused tightly, not on who wins an application, but on when one is running a top-level domain, how do they protect second-level domains from defensive registration problems. So to return to that part, Marilyn,
yes.
We're down to 4A being a new item, and would it be your preference that I would compare that to the BC's existing position, to Melbourne IT, and to the brands in order to give the BC an opportunity to comment and vote on that?
Well, I don't think we need to vote on much, Steve, right? But most of the positions are already approved positions. There's only one or two areas, right?
It's just 4A, Marilyn. I thought I said that.
Right, right. I think that would be welcome, but we're going to need to do that very quickly and take discussion on it. But I think it'd be good for people to see what's put forward. And, Steve, if you could, if you don't mind doing that comparison, we're going to go into a meeting on the 18th, which we're going to talk about in just a little bit. And out of that meeting on the 18th, I think it is very likely to assume that there will be a set of rough agreements on priorities. So the BC needs to be prepared to, if we have additional, we want improvements beyond what's there, we need to be fighting for what we want and anything that's different from what other people have on the table, and try to convince the rest of the people as much as possible in that meeting on the 18th to support our priorities.
You're correct. And the BC's priorities in terms of a block service and the fact that UDRP and URS resolutions go to some sort of a block or trademark clearinghouse, those have already been made clear. What we're dealing with here is comparisons of the how, not the whether or the what, but the how it's implemented. And I could compare your chair's proposal to the BC's existing position. I could compare it to the guidebook and what it requires today, to Melbourne IT, and to the brand letter. And it'll take a couple of pages to show these subtle distinctions and differences for people to vote upon. But keep in mind that we haven't even got any traction at ICANN to reopen the guidebook and require things like a block list of all registrants. We haven't been able to convince ICANN to require things like strings that are adjudicated in UDRP and URS automatically go into some block or suspension status.
But isn't that the purpose of our participating in the Melbourne IT event and trying to work collaboratively with the IPC on their request?
It is indeed, and I think it's sufficient for us to agree in principle on those two big changes to the guidebook without going into the details of exactly how it would be implemented. We can, if you wish, and I'm happy to do this comparison exercise for the BC, but it strikes me as it's far more important to agree on two principles, the blocking and adjudicated terms, the non-exact match terms making their way into this mechanism. Because that principle alone, we've got to justify that principle and get some governments to pressure ICANN to consider it. Otherwise, they will not modify the guidebook. Some new pressure point.
Anyone want to, I think Steve is giving us some very good advice. Anyone want to comment on that? So we're just talking really, Steve, about, I think the comparison at a high level is very helpful because when we go into the meeting, we're able to say, look at the consistency.
Exactly right, Marilyn. And it's my view that just given the positions the BC has already approved, we have significant consistency with the Melbourne IT proposal that will be discussed on the Wednesday the 18th in terms of exact match plus additional phrases and the notion of permanent blocks. So we have a lot of principle agreement that would allow us to show solidarity on the importance of moving ahead with it. If, in fact, the discussion gets into the details, we can duly note where the BC differs in important respects from the Melbourne IT proposal. So we're perfectly prepared to do that, whether or not we modify through the BC approval process anything that's somewhat different.
Why don't we just take comments on 4A, Steve, to see if members have other comments on 4A, and move ahead with focusing on what we're going to say on the 18th.
Great. Any other comments on 4A from Marilyn's letter?
One point of clarification. Is it that this block list would be operated globally, or would it be per registry?
Yeah, great question. The BC proposal would have been per registry. The block list would be in Melbourne IT, and in the brand's proposal, it's still per registry. So I have not seen a detailed proposal to make it global.
Steve, I thought actually it's Marilyn. I thought we started out in our GPML proposal. We wanted this to be global.
All right, so
it doesn't really make sense to do it on a registry-by-registry basis for open registries, does it?
No, so let me clarify. You're right, Marilyn. What we approved on January of this year includes this quote with the block list. It says, quote, "This fee per name should be a one-time fee that covers all new GTLDs through these reserved names that meet the criteria."
Right.
The BC, you're right, the BC's position was that it was global. Does that answer your question, Elisa? And that is not the position of Melbourne IT, and the brands did not explicitly say that.
We might just want to clarify that in our – I know that it says all new GTLDs, but I don't know. I'm not sure if it's
– Well, if a GTLD is an open GTLD – it's Marilyn speaking. If a GTLD is an open GTLD, then it would seem to me that everything that we're talking about has to apply to it, and no GTLD should be able to change its status. If you're a single-user GTLD, leaving aside competition issues, if you're a single-user GTLD and you're the only registrant in it, then certain things may not need to apply, but you shouldn't be able to open your registry up without going through the rest of the protective criteria, right? So what we're just looking for, I think, but we've always supported – because we weren't aware when we wrote these principles, we didn't have before us the reveal list and the different criteria. But if it's a open GTLD, don't we think that all this criteria should apply?
My answer to that is yes. And that is made – that's a decision that's proposed when an applicant files their application. But as you know, nothing about question 18 is – permanent, or even in the contract.
Which
so,
is why our comments call for.
That's right, and yet we know that a registry could open itself, start off as a closed and decide to go open, or start open and decide to go closed. They can do that. And, it does strike me, we are so close in principle, and without more momentum, we will not get ICANN to reopen the guidebook on RPMs. There's a risk that focusing on the minute differences between our proposal, the brands, and Melbourne IT, that we end up spending our time rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic here. We end up rearranging to make sure that all three of us are consistent at the detailed level when we should be actually building alliances with the people with leverage, which in many cases are governments and other members of the ICANN community. Because without that pressure, the board GTLD committee won't instruct staff to reopen the guidebook.
Dave, I hear you, but I think we actually have to have alignment. It's Maryland. We have to have alignment as much as possible to make that happen. So I think we're pretty close, and I know we're going to move to a new topic, but I think we're pretty close. If you can do that high-level, you did a great job on that last assessment. If you can do, you know, something that we can say, here's what we asked for. There's only one area in the chair's proposal that's different, and so members can comment on that separately. But mostly what we're doing, to your point, is saying, here's where we're congruent with others who are raising legitimate concerns. The competition issue that about generic words that Elisa has raised needs to be a separate topic, it seems to me, and raised as a separate topic, and maybe, as you said,
just
you and I could try to draft a statement and send out to the members for discussion on that topic.
Great. And that one is just as urgent, since the deadline for free comments is September the 26th, and then the government's early warnings will only occur through the end of November. So I'm taking two takeaways from here. The first is to compare the chair's proposal along with the guidebook, BC's existing position, Melbourne IT, and the big brands proposal. The second is to work with Elisa and you on a concern about closed generic words that might discriminate against competitors in the same industry. Is that right?
Yes.
Can I just say something? This is Gabby from A Instituto.
Yes, Gabby.
Go ahead, Gabby.
All of these items are really new for us, but at the same time, I think that everything that is said has brought some concerns about some issues because regarding awareness. Because, for instance, you have some applicants that are using trademarks. For instance, I will give the exact example is Dot Patagonia. I don't know if you heard about this. So this is a brand, it's a U.S. brand, but it's also a region in Latin America. So if you have these kind of brands, I don't know if these are high-risk marks. I'm not sure what are the great important trademarks that we are talking about or if this is for all of them. But if you have this trademark in this situation when they can avoid people, there's another example that is CBA, which is also like a short name of a region of my country, of a province. So what will happen in those cases? I'm not sure if my concerns are relevant for these discussions, but I wanted to have your feedback.
So, Gabby, it's Marilyn. Country names and regional names, and I think Chris is on the phone. Yes, Chris?
Yes, everyone.
Yes, can you maybe, you have a interest in Andalusia, so maybe Chris could make a comment about his views on country and regional names.
Just a clarification, maybe I was not clear, but Dot Patagonia is a trademark as well. It's a trademark that sells clothes. I'm not sure if this is clear.
No,
that's right, but keep in mind that it is not a country or continent name, so it is not entitled to an automatic letter of approval from a government entity. It is subject to individual protests from people, and they may try to stimulate a government to lodge a warning or an objection, but there isn't anything in the guidebook that prohibits the company Patagonia from getting the Dot Patagonia TLD.
Yes, but then now they say right now it's a closed thing and then it's an open thing, then you, or if they want this trademark to be protected in a way that no one else can have Patagonia plus other word, this would sound really strange around here.
Actually, Gabby, it's not that strange. It's Maryland. There are several words like Patagonia that fall into that category, which is why I was calling on Chris.
Yes,
Marilyn. I think just to say a couple of things. Firstly, at country and territory level, it's obviously extremely complicated. And in the present round, there is obviously protection and limited use and reserve words on this. The CCNSO have got the study group on names of countries and territories, just a study group trying to define the boundaries of what is a country name. But here we're talking of a sub-country region. Now, in those names, it gets even more complicated to such a degree that ICANN and even the GAC have almost never gone there. So I think when you read the guidebook and so on, or any other ICANN material, or even I think there's United Nations and WIPO have done reports on this, they're basically saying that there's so little protection in the real world at the moment that to start trying to protect regional names is near on impossible, so everyone's just kicking that one down the street. So I guess that Patagonia being a bona fide trademark of a in somewhere in the world, I don't know which country it is, for a business, then the BC doesn't have any problem with that. That would be my summary of the situation.
I think Chris is correct, Gabby, because, again, we supported the notion of brand owners applying for a single registrant TLD, and Patagonia did that in the proper way. So the guidebook would not rule it out, and the BC wouldn't have a position against it. If, however, the Patagonian peoples or community had filed a community application for .Patagonia and they scored through the community 14 points, then they would automatically prevail. And the BC did have a position of favoring the use of this GTLD expansion for things like geographic communities that felt they were underserved.
Okay, but maybe I was confused about something here, but I just used the example of .Patagonia because you know it, but not in the sense of an application, but in the sense of a trademark. And then if you have examples like that of trademarks that in the U.S., doesn't mean anything because everything is so U.S. focused right now. So your trademarks might mean something else in other places. That's what I meant, not about the application and about the possibility of Patagonia being an applicant. And I was meaning something else. What about these trademarks that are from the U.S. that mean something else in other countries, and then you are forbidding anyone else to have... Well, that's my concern, but maybe I will think more about this and I will write an email about this and clarify my ideas. So thank you.
That's great. And you'll notice that Patagonia was, for a while, the most commented upon string in the open comment period right now.
Yes, I know.
Some folks objected to the fact that the brand wanted a regional name, and they would have to rely on the GAC to stop that, and others were concerned about the policies of the company Patagonia, which does want to run it as a single registrant TLD. So any other comments? And I want to get this thing turned back over to Marilyn.
Thank you. I'm just going to, Gabby, thank you, whatever you can send to the list for discussion, I think that'd be fantastic. I think it is probably not an isolated example. It is a existing example, but we can take up use the resources of other members who are engaged in these considerations to respond. We want to develop a strategy for the BC input and talking points into Toronto, and I'm going to just say I'm going to pause this and talk about the September 18th meeting a little bit later because we'll be using that meeting and online discussions. I want to move to an update on the elections because I know we're really pushing time, and there's a few things we just really need to cover from informational perspectives. Vinny, if you could just overview our election time frame for the councillor election, then I'll speak about the GNSO Council Chair and Vice Chair election discussion.
Yes, of course. This is Benedetta speaking. So the nomination period, the two-week nomination period for the
councillor election opens on September the 3rd, and it closes on this Friday, September the 14th. Then the next deadline is for any nominees will need to submit their candidate statements to the BC Votes email address by September the 14th so that they can be posted to the BC list by the 15th, right before the discussion with the candidates open, which opens on September the 17th through to the 19th. On the 19th, we will have the candidates' call, which will be recorded and transcribed and then posted to the BC list. The ballot will then be distributed by the voting officer, myself, on the 19th of September, and voting will officially open on the 20th of September and close on the 26th. The announcement of the outcomes will be posted to the list on the 28th of September.
Thanks, Betty. Do we have any questions? I'll just remind everyone that in order to be a candidate, you have to have been a paid-up member for at least a year. The councillor position term is 2 years, and it ends right before, it ends actually during an ICANN meeting, after the council meeting, with the incoming councillor taking the seat in a special session, similar to how the board operates. So if you have any other questions about the election process, you can send them to Benny. The election officer that will be verifying the election is Glenda Saint-Jury. Benny, is that right?
Yes, that's right. She's the verifying officer.
Okay. So the other thing I'll just say to all of you is there's only one person in your company who is authorized to be the voting member. You, if you don't know who that is, send Benny an email. And if you haven't yet paid your dues, you can send Benny an email about your qualification to vote. There's a couple of companies who are working out the details, and so their status is not in question. But primarily, we're going to, for the most part, anyone who hasn't expressed a concern about the logistics of closing their vote, their dues, sorry, we're closing the dues payment process, and that determines eligibility to vote. I want to talk about the election update for the GNSO Council, the chair and the vice chair, for a few minutes. I'm going to do that very quickly. The chair position is elected by the councillors based on input that the councillors receive through their executive committees. And the chair requires a vote of 60% from both houses. There are two houses in the GNSO Council. One is the contracted party house. The other is the non-contracted party house. There's a chair elected 60% from each side, and then there's a vice chair from each house. So we are now beginning the process with our colleagues in discussing advancing the candidates for such positions. There is a call tomorrow with the CSG leadership where we're going, that's the executive committees of the three constituencies, where we're going to be talking about chair candidates and talking about vice chair candidates. I've already reached out to the chair of the NCUC to consider what their views are on vice chair and chair candidates, and we will be coming back to the BC in an informational discussion, but do understand that this election is an election about the council. It is not, the GNSO Policy Council is not the chair of the GNSO, and so the electorate is the councillors who focus on leadership for the policy process at ICANN. So John and Zaid will cast the votes for the BC. Working collaboratively with the other constituencies, not just in the CSG but also in the NCSG, is going to be required in order to get agreement on a vice chair for our house. Right now, the vice chair this year has been Wolf Ulrich, a member of the ISP constituency. He is not standing again. and it's likely he won't be standing again from my conversations with him. He is considering whether or not it's possible he could stand, and he will come back to us on that, but at this point, that has not been made clear one way or the other. It's very likely there will be a candidate from the NCUC. You do have to be a counselor in order to be a candidate. So there's a limited pool to consider for the candidacy. We'll be picking that discussion up in a CSG call, then each of the constituencies will come back to their community and be talking to them about what the options are, what the practicalities are, and the votes. Then there'll be election held in each house, and then an election held for the chair. During Toronto, there will be interviews with the chair candidates for the counselors to raise questions with the chairs. That will be done in an open setting. Any questions about? I think John's on the phone. I know Zaid is not with us, but any questions? Probably John and I are going to try to answer.
Marilyn, Steve, a question if you would know, who are the NCUC candidates that are interested in chair or vice chair?
We're negotiating right now with the NCUC on a single candidate for chair that could receive support from both sides. It's unlikely that a non-contracted party house representative, as you know from the last call we had, really the CSG does not have a candidate for chair, and the NCUC has a complication in they probably don't have a candidate for chair that could receive votes either from the contracted party house. So it's likely that the candidate for chair would come from the contracted party house. On vice chair, that's a different issue. Again, the CSG doesn't really have candidates that could win an election or that have... a record of sufficient time available. So any chair for the candidate for vice chair, if it's not Wolf, would probably come from the the NCUC. So I'm being a bit vague because we haven't had our meeting yet, but tomorrow should give us more information to share with all of you.
Thank you.
The vice chair position is a very heavy administrative or organizational position, and the first vice chair was Mary Wong. We didn't get a lot of direct support from Mary on outreach, but it was a new position, and the vice chair probably didn't really understand their role. Wolf has done more to do outreach, but that position is still really, I think, developing and in its effectiveness. And one of the things I think we need to ask is, what does the vice chair does that helps us in terms of administrative organization and helps the counselors? And I need to leave that to the counselors because they are really the people who have to rely on that coordinating aspect within the council. Where, John, did you want to make any comments?
I think I'm going to wait till after the call tomorrow to figure out what's best to be said and whose support
right.
The BC should have and like that. So I'm going to keep my powder dry at this point.
I will send a note to the BC members on how we're going to deal with nominating committee selection process. It will be a process that asks members to look at the work requirements and indicate their interest, and then the executive committee will make two appointments. one representing large business and one representing small business, but I'll send that out in detail to the BC list. There's a number of members who will not be eligible to nominate themselves because of conflicts of interest. You'll see that. That's not criteria that we established. That's criteria established by the BMG based on a recent experience with issues about adherence to respective conflicts of interest. So when you see that, you'll be able to determine whether you're eligible to nominate yourself. If you want to be on the nominating committee, it is a huge amount of work, but it's a very important set of work as well. So we'll send that out by email, and then members can submit their information, and the executive committee will make the appointments. We're running out of time, but we have a council agenda that's got a huge number of issues on it, and I don't want to – I think we ought to devote the next 10 minutes at least to that, Steve.
All right, and I circulated a summary of what council will look at this week in their meeting on the 13th of September. And, John, since you're with us on the call, why don't you take us through those items under Channel 2 for council?
So right now, Steve, right now I am doing about 65 miles an hour on Interstate 205 in Oregon. And it would be very helpful if you could cite them. But my last reading of the agenda is that there are no motions on which to vote, but that there are two or three significant discussions. There's a wrap discussion, there's a who is discussion, and then a couple of subjects at which the board has asked for input. So if you could...
I can walk through those and then you could comment on them.
Great, thanks.
Great, you're right. The first thing on the consent, they call it a consent agenda item. So there's a letter from council back to the board regarding these internationalized registration data and their working group report. Since it's on the consent agenda, John, I don't think that one probably requires any controversy or discussion.
No, it doesn't.
But got it. So the third item, not on the consent agenda, was the council's action on the registration abuse policies recommendation on uniformity of reporting. And council is going to consider whether to take action on that. And from your knowledge and what's on list, what is the controversy there?
Well, you know, I truthfully don't know. Mikey is going to be on the call to offer further comment. The last presentation that he made to the council struck me as perhaps seeing some smoke but not really finding any fire. I will be open to listening as to what exactly the problem is that needs to be solved, because I just don't think the data that he presented last time suggested that there be anything to be done, but I'm open to it, and if there's anybody on the call that has a keener, closer sense of it, I'm more than happy to hear your view.
All right, John, the next one is the affirmation review team for WHO is finished their final report, and you remember it included many recommendations for ICANN to proceed on. And, of course, that report was given to the board of ICANN. That's what the affirmation reviews are for. And Susan Kawaguchi on the phone, she was on the group. But the board turned around and passed a resolution asking the GNSO for its input before the board considers taking action on the recommendations. The BC came in and said, it's fine to ask council for how, but don't ask council whether to proceed, because we said that affirmation recommendations carry special status. So this is a discussion. Is council, do you even have a draft circulating on council on what the response to the board would look like?
I haven't seen it. I know there's been discussion. My contribution on this is that this is really a matter that ought to be left to the constituencies, the supporting organizations, I mean the constituencies and the stakeholder groups. And I know that, I am concerned that some of the way that the responsibility of the constituency seems to be leaking into the council, something that Marilyn and I have talked about. So I don't know exactly what the what the point will be of the group that was pulled together to draft this. I just know that the activity was underway, but I haven't seen any product.
John, if you get a hold of a draft response, circulate it to the BC so we'll all have an opportunity to comment, too.
Steve, it's Marilyn. Apparently, Zaid joined that group. We haven't had any feedback or prior notice about that. Maybe what we should do is ask, if you don't mind sending an email to Zaid and John, and then we should, each the chairs have been asked to send a contribution to the board chair. I've sent out the original list of what I would propose to say. That's on the agenda later. I'll come to that. But maybe what we should do is ask for the list of the participants and try to arrange a discussion in, because I see that this topic is on the agenda for Toronto, so it probably would be good to modify that agenda and ask to have a presentation from the chairs on the positions taken by each of the constituencies and then a discussion with that working group of the council.
The working group, the drafting team, I think you're saying, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, I'll put a note into Zahid, copy XCOM on that. Remember that the BC, with Susan's help and Elisa's leadership, the BC filed extensive comments on the WHO is affirmation recommendations. And again, our position is, our official position for John and Zahid is that it's not whether to do these things, but there are legitimate discussions about how to do them. Okay. The next item on the council's agenda is sort of a report from this WHO is Proxy Privacy and Reveal, Relay and Reveal Feasibility Survey. That's the Inter-Isle Consulting Report. And again, this is a consulting report that said, yeah, there's some challenges, but it could be done. And the BC's position on these WHO is studies is proceed, because we want to be fact-based in coming up with WHO is policies. This is unrelated to verifying the identity of WHO is data or accuracy. This is all about what a registrar or proxy privacy service must do when they are noticed, and we want to get fact-based information on how promptly they relay or reveal when folks like Facebook and others provide them with evidence of actionable harm. That's going to be a report, no vote. There's a drafting team for fake renewal notices, and they're giving a report to council. That's just a report. There's an update on protecting international organizations and the new GTLD plan and folks like Red Cross and the Olympics. And then there's a discussion, John, on the impact of all these new GTLDs on ICANN's structure. The board has asked the GNSO for some response, knowing that those changes are heading at about the same time the bylaws require GNSO to do a review with a potential restructuring. What are you hearing from List about the elements of that discussion?
Well, again, there really hasn't been much except the stirring of the pot that something likely is going to have to happen. So I really haven't heard any specific proposals. But again, this is something that I think needs to come from the constituencies first. And I'm, you know, essentially the GNSO Council has a conflict of interest in talking about the how ICANN is going to look for, different structurally.
And, John, the BC didn't have a formally adopted position on this question, but I think there's pretty fair consensus, and Marilyn's articulated it a few times, that we do not want to proceed with a full-blown review of GNSO right in the middle of the implementation of new GLDs. So there's a timing issue that would it would make sense to get going on the new GTLD implementation, the integration of all these new members into the various constituencies, and then look at a review. Marilyn, does that capture your sentiments on that?
Let me just clarify. Let me make a distinction between the words review and restructuring. We don't want to support a restructuring. A review is, of course, very possible, but a review is basically a technical review. Do the constituencies have websites? Do they have email? Are they following transparency and accountability? That's what a review is about. Restructuring, I think, is the thing that we don't want to support at this point.
Great. Hey, John, last two items. Last item really is the planning that you plan to do on the council call for something that will happen in Toronto. It's a GAC-initiated high-level meeting with GNSO. And you usually, on council, do that planning on the Saturday before. In this case, you're doing it, you know, a full month ahead of time because I think the stakes are pretty high. The GAC wants to have a high-level discussion and with scheduled speakers from GNSO. So in your planning for that, I would encourage you to find ways to get members of your constituency into a position to comment on things that the BC feels are really important.
Noted. No, I think it's important, and I think that the reason we're having the discussion a month in advance is because not only is the GAC seeking to have more of exert more influence, but there's recognition that they are exerting more influence, and so really shouldn't be left until a couple till the day before the meeting.
That's it, Marilyn, for report on council. Over to you.
Thanks. Let me follow up with I think I forwarded the present draft of the high-level meeting, which I initially got off the council list. The high-level meeting with governments will take place on Monday, and actually it's really not clear that the council will be determinant in who the high-level participants meet with. I'm hearing that the meeting with the GAC, with the council, may be moved to Saturday, John?
Yeah, I'm hearing that there's some shifting going on as well. There's some grumbling about that, but yes, it is in play.
So I would just say from a BC perspective, what we care most about is having the GAC meeting, and it's probably, in my personal view, it probably is not well received by government attendees when they hear that grumbling. So I'm hoping that the BC is not associated with the grumbling, since undoubtedly our priority is having a GAC and a council discussion. But I take your point. If the meeting with the GAC moves to Saturday, that will provide some other opportunities for change in the Saturday schedule. We'll do our update from Benny on when the BC will be meeting in Toronto and what our purposes are by email, not to take this time up. The high-level meeting with the governments will take place on Monday, and the GAC members, the high-level participants, will attend the opening ceremony. They will then begin their high-level meetings. The governments will be meeting with ICANN and talking about the role of governments within ICANN. Then they will be meeting with the global Internet community. It's unclear right now what opportunities that represents for interactions, but they're unlikely to be asking GNSO Council for that. I think that's more ISOC leadership, senior business leadership, and other parties. But the primary topic is how the government views the success of the multi-stakeholder role and how ICANN is fulfilling the affirmation of commitments. There are two major areas in the affirmation of commitments ICANN has not addressed. Both of them lie in the David Olive and the John Jeffrey role, and they've been raised as serious issues of concern. So that's something for us to both want to attend, and I'll just mention the time frames when I finish the review. Session 3 is a meeting with the ICANN board. There's a long list of topics. You've seen that. I'll have Benny send it out again. And then session 4 is a meeting with the other ICANN stakeholder groups. And here, the request has already been sent to the high-level government representatives that meeting be with chairs of the constituencies and the SGs from the stakeholder groups, as well as the chairs of the policy council from the GNSO and the ASO, CCNSO, and who am I missing? ESSAC. Hard to tell what they're going to do, but that is going to be an all-day meeting. Basically, that means basically you will be hypothetically able to observe and maybe participate in a meeting that runs from 11 a.m. on Monday. The welcome lunch is governments only. The BC will be holding a separate meeting of our own during that luncheon period since it's closed. And then the high-level meeting should resume with observer status available. They end at 5:45. Right now there's a reception with the ICANN board and the governments. I have asked the GAC to open that reception to the full community. I don't know what's going to happen on that because of the funding, but when I saw the agenda, I did ask to have that reception opened. If it's not opened, then we may want to do something else on a more bilateral basis following the high-level meeting. It's unclear how many high-level members will come. I've also sent an invitation to the GAC to attend breakfast with the three constituencies on Tuesday morning, which would include any of the high-level representatives who then stay over. I think most of you are familiar with the distinction between the people who come from a high-level perspective. They will not be taking GAC chairs. They will be holding their own meeting and then probably leaving on Tuesday, and then the GAC goes back to work. The Canadian government is chairing, and it is not the GAC chair is a co-chair and a moderator, but it is being hosted and organized by a senior official at the Canadian government. So it's a little bit of a – it's a long – just for anyone who's worrying about this, this was asked for in the President's Strategy Committee, and then in the Affirmation of Commitments. It's taken a long time to organize. It's probably a strategic event in the sense that it's an opportunity to show that ICANN is fulfilling its role in the multi-stakeholder environment, given what is happening later in the year with the ITU Treaty Conference and other things. There are a number of governments who think that this is a great opportunity to show that ICANN's working. So it may be a very opportune time for us to be there and have private interactions, and even maybe arrange some bilaterals. I think it'd be a shame if the GNSO Policy Council decided that this was about GNSO policy, about GTLDs, because that's not going to be a good report card for ICANN. So I'm hoping that's not going to be what the input, John, if you and Saeed can influence that, that would not be the input from the council on what the topic should be. It also displaces, and since there will be a meeting between the GAC and the council on Saturday, I'm hoping that that is where the work efforts related to policy work would take place. We're out of time. I just want to say a couple of words about the BC Outreach event on the 18th, and before I do that, I'll send out an email about the staff proposal. The staff has proposed an intersessional event in January. That is not what the community asked for, but it is what the staff has proposed. There's a $150,000 budget associated with it. I did ask the staff to provide two options, one being a officers meeting and provide the funding back to the constituencies to help the constituencies bring members to the Beijing meeting. I'll distribute the draft document through the BC list for all of you to comment on. In the meantime, we will have a BC outreach event on the 18th
in Washington. We'll send a draft agenda out for that. It's only a half day. We'll have dial-in. We will have a interaction with Bruce Tonkin and at least one other board member as a roundtable. And then in the afternoon, Melbourne IT has established a discussion about defensive registrations. The BC will have at least one speaking slot at that meeting. Other members from the BC who register will be able to offer comments. The purpose of that meeting, and I think, you know, our goal is to use it to our advantage as opposed to others using it to their advantage, but the purpose of that meeting is to try to come up with a set of congruent proposals for improvements so that when we go into, when all of us go into the ICANN meeting in Toronto, there's a strong call for improvements in the RPMs. At this point, my concern is that the BC gets their positions, and Steve, thank you so much for taking the lead on this with the input from our members, but our positions, we need to figure out what's practical, what's realistic, what's achievable, and understand that we're not going to get more than one bite at the board. So if the board is getting such diverse suggestions that they can justify not doing something or sending this work back to the GNSO Council, they will do that. If they get a congruent enough set of calls for change, then we may be able to affect the changes in the Trademark Clearinghouse, the URS, and other mechanisms and information that we're asking for. So that discussion is going to be really critical for us both online, at the meeting on the 18th, we'll have dial-in for the BC part of our meeting, and I understand from Bruce that there will be remote participation also for the session that Melbourne IT is hosting, but we're going to have presence in the room to contribute to insisting on what we want. Otherwise, the room will be filled by people who want different things than what we want. Was that subtle enough in my effort to ask you to register for the Melbourne meeting? Let me...
Well, good point about, I mean, I had said earlier, if we're 80% in agreement on principle, isn't that sufficient to generate momentum? And I think you raise an interesting point that if 20% differences look like they are major,
right,
it becomes an excuse to say that there's no consensus here. It's too early to proceed. I think
right.
I see your point. Tough to find the right balance without getting so down in every detail of implementation, but I catch your point.
You know, Steve, I think the other thing that the BC has consistently done is we've said continue this until the evaluation, while others have said don't do anything until the evaluation. And I think if we can promote the idea that our suggestions should be instituted and then evaluated, we're able to stand up to evaluation. If the improvements we ask for aren't needed, then when the evaluation is done, they can be discontinued.
That's right. And with respect to keeping trademark claims notices running, we're on a very strong ground because it's already going to be built as part of the current RPMs. And we're extending that same view to the other new items we're asking for.
So Benny is going to send out a request for all of you to let her know when you're coming, when you're arriving in Toronto. We've taken up a lot of your time today. We owe you further written information. Thank you for your patience and for participating. And is there anyone who wants to make a final comment or ask a question?
Okay, I will say something else. This is again Gabby.
Yes, Gabby.
I would like to explore some ideas about doing events also in Latin America about these issues. I think they are very important, and as you were saying at the beginning, that also the U.S. participants are concerned about not having brands or organizations that aggregate those brands from other countries involved in these discussions, I would like to explore ideas about how to do this around here with your help, if that's possible.
I think, so why don't we, why don't you and I have a call maybe tomorrow or the next day?
Excellent. That would be great.
And for those of you on the call, Gabby will be coming to Toronto, which is fantastic news. And so you'll be seeing her. She'll be in the newcomer's lounge for the first 3 days, right, Gabby?
Yes, until Wednesday.
So we'll have to steal her away for Tuesday, but it's fantastic you're going to be there.
Thank you.
Okay, we're wrapping up. Any other comments? Benny will give me my list of things I've agreed to send out. Steve, thank you so much for picking this up, and John, for your diligence and participation. I really, the feedback about what's going on in the council is very helpful to all of us, and we wish you a good call. I think if there's something that you think we need to get to you before that call, can you just send an email to the XCOM list, and we will see you on the XCOM call tomorrow.
Thanks, Marilyn.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.